Tanto Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What Kind of Bird Can't Fly? A Memoir of Resilience and Resurrection by Dorsey Nunn with Lee Romney. Forward by Michelle Alexander. Narrated by Jeremy Midnight Michael Durham. Forward. Michelle Alexander. Toni Morrison once said, "Just remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to free somebody else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else." As far as I know, Toni Morrison never met Dorsey Nunn. But I can say, without hesitation, that Dorsey has been living for decades according to the ethical code that she described. It's a code that values what you do more than what you say, and that insists on leaving no one behind. It's a code rooted in a very simple truth. All of us deserve freedom, dignity, and power. All of us, or none. I've known Dorsey for 2 decades. I've watched him grow and evolve into an extraordinary thinker and leader, someone who has helped to birth and shape movements that are changing the course of history. Today, thanks to movements that Dorsey and many others have built, more than 230 million people in the U.S. now live in jurisdictions that have banned the box on employment applications. That dreaded box asking, "Have you ever been convicted of a felony?" In this era of mass incarceration, that box has made survival difficult and sometimes impossible for tens of millions of formerly incarcerated or convicted people, and that box has helped to lock them into a permanent second-class status. But because of the heroic work of Dorsey and all those in the organizations that he led or co-founded, and the powerful movements that he has helped to build, barriers to employment, housing, education, and more have begun to fall away for millions of people, overwhelmingly poor people and people of color, who've been ensnared by our nation's criminal punishment system. The vital grassroots movement-building work to which Dorsey has dedicated his life has touched and changed countless lives, shifted public consciousness, and demonstrated the brilliance, creativity, and resilience of the very people our nation has treated as disposable. So much of what I've come to know and understand over the years about the second-class status imposed upon people labeled criminals or felons, I've learned from Dorsey and the people who comprise All of Us or None, an organization he co-founded. Although I have fancy degrees and Dorsey does not, there's never been a time in our friendship in which he hasn't been schooling me. Not so much in theory, but in practice. As he notes in the following, in academic circles, people sometimes ask, "What's your theory of change?" Dorsey has much to say about theory, having deepened his political education both in and outside of prison. But what he values most is what people do in practice. As he sees it, theories of change are nice, but the real question should be, what is your motherfucking practice? As long as I've known him, Dorsey's practice has been to show up for those who are locked up and locked out with love, honesty, courage, and a fierce determination to gain power and freedom for all those left behind. He's the first to admit that he's made mistakes, big and small, during his journey from incarceration addiction to movement leadership, but he's never claimed perfection, only commitment to his practice. In my experience, Dorsey always aims to practice what he preaches. And oh, can he preach? Dorsey and I first met back in the late 1990s, in the midst of the Get Tough era, when incarceration rates were soaring, as Democrats and Republicans were competing with each other to escalate the war on drugs and to pass laws imposing ever harsher sentences on the crimes committed by the least advantaged. We were both living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, and we were both working at social justice organizations that were trying to resist the assault on our communities. Dorsey was a staff member at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, which he would later leave, and I was the director of the Racial Justice Project of the ACLU of Northern California, focused mainly on litigation and organizing work challenging racial profiling and police misconduct. I was also teaching a class on race and criminal justice at Stanford Law School. I thought it would be a good idea to invite Dorsey to speak to my students. Little did I know what was to come. Dorsey blew them away. Throughout the semester, my students had heard from, in person or on paper, legal scholars, criminal justice experts, organizers, public defenders, and prosecutors, including one guest speaker, a local prosecutor, who went on to become Attorney General of California and Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris. None of the guests or authors did more to inform, inspire, and challenge my students than Dorsey Nunn. Not even close. First thing Dorsey said when he stepped in front of my class was, "Oh shit, I've never been invited to speak at a law school before. I'm a little nervous." He immediately caught himself, clapped his hand over his mouth, and said, sorry. Can I curse up here? You know, that's just how I talk." I laughed and said, "Sure, Dorsey, you can say whatever you want." And then he let it rip. He told us in his own words, in his authentic voice, about his childhood, all the fear, grief, intermittent joy, and struggle. And he explained exactly how and why he was imprisoned for first-degree murder. He was unflinchingly honest about everything, about the violence and harm that he had experienced throughout his life, as well as the violence and harm that he had inflicted on others. My students were riveted. Then, without pausing to take a breath, Dorsey told us exactly why he believed that our so-called justice system was completely fucked up. His scathing critique was full of stories about himself and others that made us want to scream, cry, and revolt. Truth rained down on my class for nearly 2 hours. Some of his truths hit hard like hail, causing us to flinch and want to run for cover. Other stories had us nearly weeping. And sometimes, miraculously, Dorsey had us laughing. Not at the tragedy, but at the moments of absurdity that could be found amid it all. His talk was only supposed to last for 45 minutes, but my students wouldn't let him go. They kept asking him questions, hungry for the kind of unfiltered truth-telling that Dorsey was offering straight from the heart. After he left, one of my students said, "I'll never ever forget that guy." The entire class murmured agreement. Years later, I ran into one of those students on the street. She was working as a public defender and involved in multiple grassroots organizations aiming to dismantle mass incarceration and to support those cycling in and out of prison. "Dorsey Nunn changed my life," she told me. After he came to class that day and told his story, I knew nothing would ever be the same for me. I've been hoping that Dorsey would publish a memoir ever since. Many years ago, I told him that. He laughed and said, "Nah, I don't have time for shit like that. Besides, I don't know how to write a book." Fortunately, my words stuck with him, and all these years later, he's partnered with Lee Romney, an outstanding writer and journalist, to support the writing of this wonderful memoir, one that is even more moving and illuminating than the speech he delivered to my Stanford Law class. Why? Because this book contains the stories of another 2 decades of organizing, movement building, and personal, as well as political, struggle. The documenting of this history serves our movements, and Dorsey's honesty and vulnerability regarding the deeply personal dimensions of this journey allow us, as listeners, to experience transformation and not merely get an education. Thank you, Dorsey, for this wonderful gift. You've long been an inspiration to me, and this remarkable book reveals exactly why. Preface. I was well into my 7th decade of life when I realized I needed to tell my story. It was a time of urgent work, accompanied by deep reflection, and in the rearview mirror, I could see my personal and professional journeys intertwined with history like a braid. Like just about everyone I grew up with, I graduated from street thug to prisoner, just in time to experience one of the most violent decades in California prison history. But this isn't a prison memoir, and it's not a personal redemption story, although I've done all right on that front. This book is about camaraderie, commitment, and grassroots organizing. Prison introduced me to more brutality than any human being should experience. But inside those walls, I also learned the art of critical analysis from Revolutionary Brothers. When I finally walked out, I made a promise to honor the unrecognized brilliance of those I left behind and the millions of others who find themselves similarly situated. I made a commitment to fight for our collective dignity, for our liberty, and for the full restoration of our civil and human rights. I can honestly say that, even in times of darkness, I never wavered. The prison-industrial complex would transform into a Goliath more damaging than any of us standing shoulder to shoulder in the trenches could have foreseen. But we fought like David, like an army of Davids. As formerly incarcerated people, we insisted on speaking in our own voices, on becoming the architects of our own destiny. Our fight is not over, but we have changed the arc of history in this country. It's a story that needs telling. It is my story, and the story of a movement that keeps on gaining strength. My search for a co-writer led me to Lee Romney, a former journalist for the Los Angeles Times who had covered my work over the course of a decade. She was there in 2005 for our first policy victory as a grassroots coalition of formerly incarcerated people when we persuaded the city and county of San Francisco to remove the box that asked about conviction history from public employment applications. She kept track of our work, and in 2015, chronicled my trip to Washington, D.C. with other formerly incarcerated leaders to meet with Obama administration officials. Lee's investigative skills supplemented our continuous conversation over 3 years by pulling in interviews and archival research. We collaborated on the writing and editing of my story to create this book, and I'm grateful to Lee for going on this journey with me. I come from a family with a legendary capacity to string cuss words together and make them sound like poetry. I'm a formerly incarcerated black man who has pledged my primary allegiance to people locked in cages and coming out of cages. I swear like a motherfucker. I've learned to rein it in. As the executive director of a nonprofit legal organization, I've had to. But I aim to use my authentic voice in my own memoir. You will encounter some choice swears, but trust us, we thin them out considerably. Lastly, when I speak, I mostly speak black English, unless I'm code-switching. When I write, I veer towards so-called standard English. In this memoir, you'll notice those same shifts in diction. I hope you find meaning, rage, and hope in what's to come. Introduction. On a Friday afternoon in the spring of 2003, about 50 of us formerly incarcerated people filed with singular purpose into the high-ceilinged parlor of a Victorian house with peeling purple trim near Oakland's Lake Merritt. The drapes didn't match, the chairs didn't match, and neither did the sofas. To some, the people gathering might not have seemed to match either, but in our common experience, we were as one. The well-worn house was headquarters of the Center for Third World Organizing, which a local newspaper article had described as a halfway house for hell-raising that helps communities take matters into their own hands. To us, it felt like home. Other than the kids who played on the royal blue carpet in the corner we set up for childcare, just about every man and woman who walked through the door knew what it was like to live in a cage. Most of us were from the Bay Area, but some had come all the way from New York, others from Seattle, a few from Southern California. What brought us together was a paper I wrote and passed around to every formerly incarcerated person I could think of. I called it Save Ourselves, and it was, to a word, precisely about taking matters into our own hands, those being our fundamental and thoroughly trampled civil and human rights. I couldn't have known it at the time, but the weekend organizing marathon at that house for hell-raising would define the rest of my life, launching a movement of formerly incarcerated people, acting and advocating on our own behalf that reaches from coast to coast and gets stronger by the day. It also answered, in the deepest way possible, a question that a prison elder had posed to me before I walked out of the gates of San Quentin State Prison, one that weighed on my every waking hour. What are you going to do with your newfound freedom? The work I'd been doing, first as a paralegal and then as co-director for Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, LSPC, was rewarding. As a civil rights legal nonprofit, LSPC was among the first to recognize that women, who the state was locking up at historic rates, were being denied basic dignity, health care, and other needs behind bars. What was missing was street-level advocacy from people who had the most at stake, those who'd been sucked into the prison system and spat out the other side. Us. We were an army for change, and that truth was sinking in as we deprogrammed our own minds and, leaning on each other, rebuilt our self-esteem. We were sick of being props in the hands of well-meaning attorneys and politicians who thought they knew what we needed. Sick of having our stories treated like garnish on top of a motherfucking hamburger somebody else had cooked and planned to eat. We were ready to speak in our own voices. Some gathered at the center that Friday, like George Galvis, were in their 20s. Youngsters I would go on to mentor into powerful leaders. They sat shoulder to shoulder with the gray hairs, longtime freedom fighters in the black liberation struggle that included Ronald Elder Freeman, a founding member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, who many of us had looked up to on the San Quentin Yard for his wisdom and strategy. Others were approaching solid middle age. Me, former Weather Underground member and political prisoner Linda Evans, who'd served 16 years in federal lockup, and Susan Burton, who had cycled in and out of prison herself before founding a new way of life in Los Angeles in 1998. Her safe houses were bringing stability, family unity, and recovery to women, most of them black or brown, who were coming out of cages. Recovery that would have likely kept them out of prison in the first place if they'd had the access so many wealthier, whiter women enjoyed. Every one of the people in that room would remain my comrades in the fight for our full human and civil rights. I had just returned from a trip to Africa, and George and I draped Ethiopian cloth over a table to form an altar, placing sacred African earth on top. George, a big man with an uncompromising, "I'm not here to make you feel comfortable" vibe that I like to think he modeled on my own, added an abalone shell and a ceramic vessel from Central America, filled with cedar and sage, that he lit to smudge the room. We held hands while George opened with a blessing passed down from his indigenous Colombian grandmother. An African liberation ceremony followed. Each of the 50 or so adults in that room were standing in for hundreds of thousands of other formerly incarcerated people, exiled by a society that branded us as the sum of our worst mistakes. We honored historical and intergenerational trauma, acknowledging the very first prisons in this nation as the slave plantation and the reservation. We knew it was no coincidence that people of African and indigenous descent were disproportionately represented in our prisons. We were full of love and trust for one another, but it was anger that brought us together. My relationship with anger had been evolving since I was a kid. Anger had proved essential to my survival, but the two of us had hit some rough patches and would navigate more. On this day, though, anger and I were joined in righteous purpose to demand justice. Our ancestors were in the room. Loved ones who had died behind bars and those still confined were there too. Yes, we were angry. As formerly incarcerated people, we had no control over our own agenda. And that's what we were there to change. Like George would later tell me, the erasure of our agency was like having a white driver at the wheel of the Freedom Bus at the height of the Civil Rights era, deciding which way to go. As the ones directly impacted by our incarceration histories, we were best situated to drive that bus. We were done asking permission. The next morning, we arranged the saggy couches in a circle, set up long tables, and taped our white butcher paper to the walls. One by one, we shared stories of discrimination and stigmatism we'd experienced after we paid for our crimes. The initial price was steep enough. We paid with years, decades. We paid with trauma. From violence done to us behind bars to violence that plenty of us had no choice but to bust out on others to survive. Then, when we finally walked to freedom, we paid some more. We were locked out of any meaningful chance to participate in our own communities by too many laws and policies to count. plenty of us were barely surviving. Our main goal that weekend was to settle on a collective agenda. Our stenographer stood with markers at the ready as we called out each injustice that demanded reversal. Repeal of California's three strikes law, public health effects of prison on the community, harsh parole policies. Then we each got up and placed day-glow sticky dots next to the issues we wanted to prioritize. There were many to choose from. Family reunification, prison abolition, voting rights, an end to re-entry barriers and discrimination against ex-prisoners. The last one won out. It was drowning in dots. We started pushing local government to ban that box on public employment applications that inquires about conviction history. It lands our applications in the trash can before our qualifications are ever considered. It took a while, but when we finally discovered a name for our organization, it fit like a glove. All of Us or None. It comes from a poem written by Bertolt Brecht in the 1930s and translated into English by H.R. Hayes. We were hooked from the opening stanza. Slave, who is it that shall free you? Those in deepest darkness lying. Comrade, only slaves can free you. Everything or nothing. All of us or none. It turns out the German dude wasn't just a poet, playwright, and theater director. He was a Marxist too. The poem is a call to collective action. It notes that only the downtrodden and enslaved can break their own shackles by rising up together, which is exactly what we were doing. The poem became our anthem, and the ethos at the core of our name speaks to us forcefully of our duty to write the script for our own struggle and lift up every single voice among us. No education? No problem. Swear too much and don't care to code switch. I hear you, and don't give a rat's ass. Queer or transgender? Your fight is our fight, too. When we gather to speak at public meetings or lobby state legislators, those who walked out of prison last week stand next to others who served our time decades ago. We now have chapters across the country. We banned the box on public and private employment applications in cities and states from coast to coast. And that was just the start of our practical and political work to end the ongoing oppression caused by mass incarceration. To expand our work, we joined with other organizations led by the formerly incarcerated to form a powerful national collective. Our demand is full citizenship. After I've been traveling abroad, immigration officials often ask me, "Are you a returning citizen?" For me, it evokes a deeper question. Am I an American citizen? Because if I don't have the right to vote, if I can't sit on juries, if I can't run for office, I don't have the basic rights that come with citizenship. And if I can't land a job or secure a student loan or get a professional license or rent a home, I don't have the basic right to survival. Think about this. Have you ever told a lie? Now suppose I went around introducing you to strangers year in and year out. This is so-and-so. The liar. Could you ever expect to land a good business deal, a job, a place to live, or a decent partner who believes you every time you come home late? As a proud co-founder of All of Us or None, AOUON, this is my fight. I'm now in the winter of my life, but the work is unfinished. So I keep on pushing in large and small ways that amount to big change. When that San Quentin prison elder who challenged me to be an asset to my community walked out of his cage, nearly four decades after I did, he came to my office. It was the first time he'd used local transit, and we were both proud that he'd made his way to me on his own. After we embraced, I showed him what my comrades and I had managed to build. "This," I told him, "is what I do with my freedom." Chapter 1. Innocence Unavailable. Guilt Not Required. I was 9 years old when I got my first bicycle. I came charging into the living room, half asleep, to see a pile of presents under the Christmas tree, and in front of them, a bike so perfect, it didn't need wrapping. It was deep purple with a banana seat. The handlebars, motorcycle cruiser style, seemed to reach for the ceiling in a gesture of celebration. I could tell that somebody had tricked it out, bending the front wheel's chrome forks downward for the lowrider slope. My sister Joyce, the eldest of the nine siblings, always said our parents met all our basic needs when we were kids. We had a father who worked two jobs to make sure we were fed and clothed, and a mother with a sweet disposition and a devout love of the Lord. Joyce is right. I never went hungry, but there were plenty of things I wanted that I may not have needed. That purple bike was one of them, and now it was mine. It was the cherry on top of my Christmas. We'd arrived in the Bell Haven neighborhood of Menlo Park from South San Francisco 5 years earlier. We called it East Menlo Park because even though we paid our taxes to that richer, larger city, our corner was the ugly stepsister and getting uglier by the day. Just like railroad tracks cleaved cities in the American South and left black families on the wrong side to sink into poverty, that stretch of Highway 101 to our west, known as the Bayshore Freeway, did the same. It was Northern California's first planned freeway, and it was erected like a border wall, hemming our neighborhood's triangle of streets. There are all kinds of prisons in this world. Sure as shit I'd come to know one made of steel, concrete, and razor wire, filled with the stink of fear. But that highway helped turn our tract of small suburban homes into a prison of a different kind, a formative one, where I learned to play by prison rules, where I gave up hoping and settled into plain-ass surviving. Everything to the west was a no-go zone for kids who looked like me, whites only. There was no law against us being there, but we stuck out like black beans on rice, and the powers that be made us feel more than unwelcome. Turning to the east, as a young boy, I found flashes of something that felt like freedom in the marshes of San Francisco Bay. The air left salt on our skins as we played hide-and-seek in the brush and built rafts from wooden junk that we found close to rotting in the briny mud near the railroad tracks. I was proud as hell when I shot my first rabbit. My older brothers clapped me on the back and high-fived me like I was a war hero, and damn straight we ate it, with wild greens that my sister Joyce gathered with Mom's. In some ways, it looked like the life my parents had in mind for me, Little League and all that. But by the time I was playing shortstop and second base, dreaming of making my break as a sports star, every kid on my team was black except one. That shift wasn't slow. It came on like a runaway train. Even at 9 years old, I was on high alert to the changes. On practically every street, I could pick out the homes where black families had moved in as whites sold in a hurry and left in droves. That's partly because we were already in our third house. My parents had managed to buy their first place in the Bell Haven neighborhood back in 1955 on Madera Avenue, before losing it when that low mortgage deal that probably seemed too good to be true turned into a balloon payment. At that house, I had learned with a racing heart to ride a bike on one I borrowed from some other kid. Onetta Harris was one of our neighbors. A devoted community activist, she made sure all our families were fed. Thanks to Onetta, we ate plenty of government cheese, because even working two jobs, my father had too many mouths to feed. Harris is what black descendants of that crazy time of transformation call a root family name, tethered in history to early black settlers in my San Francisco suburb, just like none is. Our second house, after the one on Madera Avenue, was four blocks away on a quiet, curling cul-de-sac called Henderson Place. And by the time we got there, there were a couple of other black kids on the block I could horse around with long after the street lights came on. By the time I woke up to that magic purple bike, we'd moved yet again, a short two-block hop to Hollyburn Avenue. In retrospect, I believe that with all those whiplashing moves, my father was chasing a better way of living for us kids, in a safer environment. He was always aspiring to that community, barely within reach, the wider one, the one that didn't want us. Some moves were aspirational like that. Others were just damn necessary, because my pops couldn't afford to stay where we'd been. Hollyburn Avenue was a good landing spot, though, because that's where Nate Harrington stayed, three houses down, and he and I got tight as twins. Only a few more years would pass before we learned together to hate the pigs for thinking us thieves when we were just being boys.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?